Welcome to Beyond Cast Derbys. My name is Christian Corley, and with me is James McLean. Hi, James.
Hello.
Hello. Now, we are here, as you can probably tell by the title, to have a chat about a recent movie that, if you haven't heard about it, then I don't know how you got hold of this podcast, frankly, because there's no way in the world you could be listening to any podcast about anything that's been released in the last few weeks and not know about Avengers Endgame.
It is, in fact, crazy that you are actually listening to another podcast or news source about Avengers Endgame, because I doubt we were the first place you'd come to. So why you've come. Not. Yeah.
Well, no, well, maybe our experience in doing podcasts and maybe a few insights that we have for discussing other topics maybe inform some interesting conversation. I mean, it's a risk you're going to have to take, quite frankly, dear listener. And there's just a lot of talk about with regards to Endgame. So before we do that, shall we just underline that Avengers Endgame has broken a huge selection of box office records already. And at the time of recording this, it's been out a week. So, you know, in North America, it's took in $350 million over the weekend and $1.2 billion total worldwide at the weekend, which is just insane. I mean, it's very different to get these sorts of things in perspective, but you know that those figures are huge, and it's looking likely that, you know, this huge plan that Marvel have been working to is paying off for them in a massive way. Now, I don't know about you, James. I only saw Captain Marvel about 4 weeks ago.
I saw it when it came out. But
right.
Yeah, so I
saw it at the end of its first month, I suppose. So to me, it's felt... I've basically seen three Marvel films on the trot at the cinema, with basically Infinity War, then Captain Marvel, then Endgame. And in many ways, it feels like Captain Marvel's a kind of handy sidestep, which is easily... Which is conveniently kind of... You know, it's... The reason to consider it is that, like, a flashback sidestep sort of thing is there in the closing sequence of Infinity War as Nick Fury reaches for his pager and then gets dusted. You've got that nice little Captain Marvel sidestep to then lead into Endgame.
It is the mission to the unknown, isn't it?
Of the Marvel Universe. Yeah, yeah. So there's, you know, it's a three-hour movie. There's plenty we can talk about. There's plenty that we're going to miss out for various reasons. I mean, I'm going to say that I left the cinema extremely, extremely, extremely pleased. And, you know, a lot of the Marvel films have really, really excited me over the past few years. We did a podcast on Thor Ragnarok, didn't we? Which
probably.
I love watching Ragnarok. It's a great film, Ragnarok. It still plays well now. Maybe, you know, the older Thor film, the previous two Thor films don't. I'm not a big fan of Iron Man 3, for example. Well, certainly not the last sort of 40 minutes of it. I did find it like a bit of a visual mess. But Endgame really doesn't have much wrong with it. But I am going to start with a negative. And this isn't just about Endgame. This is Marvel in general. Hulk in general. I don't like Bruce Hulk.
Okay.
I've never liked the intelligent Bruce Banner Hulk combination. For me, Hulk has to be that dangerous binary rivalry between Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Bruce Banner and the Hulk. And once you merge them into this nice big green guy, it doesn't work for me. It loses me.
I really liked it in the comic. Remember when they did it, so like in the early 1990s, and
yeah,
he dubbed him Professor Hulk.
Yeah.
And he was, it was a Peter David was writing it at the time, who, for those who don't know, has written many good stuff in the past. But he, I enjoyed it. I found it quite refreshing. And it was also visually quite fun because you could have him sitting there with spectacles and large, fluffy, pink rabbit slippers, all green, and there was, yeah, something quite amusing to contend with. And in comic format, I actually found it more enjoyable because I think comics are so the potential for spectacle is, you know, as big as you want. Hulk doesn't really do anything more than anyone else could do in that sense. Do you know what I mean? As the binary, I don't think he carries the impact. In film, oddly enough, he rarely carries impact. And I've had this conversation recently with a friend, my issues with the Hulk, which maybe we'll go into. But I quite liked him in this, but I can see what you mean. Because what you mean is my argument of where every Hulk film has failed. And I probably have said this on podcasts before. And to me, the mistake with the Hulk always is that the engagement for the audience is the creating a dramatic moment and a catharsis of a point where a person goes beyond their anger goes beyond the point of no return. And dramatically, you should really milk that. And that's what films are good at. You milk drama. And yet they never do. So, you know, his change will be almost like an afterthought, and the big thing will be him smashing things. And it's like, well, anything post-1999 can smash things, any monster. You need is that changeover. It's that change. It's having someone struggling against something. They can't do it. It could be something mundane, like in the original, like in the TV show, like changing a tire, not being able to get through to the operator on a telephone. It could be something really quite important, you know, being unable to save someone you love, trying, you can't get through, you're trying. You really milk that to a point where the audience feels so frustrated, then you do the change. And that's where the catharsis is. And films never do that. I've not seen one film make that twig that's where you really milk the audience's interest in the character. So in a sense, Mark Ruffalo's version has always been okay with me, because I've got to the point where I was like, well, they're never going to do that, so fine. You know, in the first Avengers, he sort of goes, yeah, now I know how to control my anger, I can use it. So he just changes what he wants. So he's no different really to Superman or anyone else like that. And the other thing is, of course, with the binary in the films, he's kind of funny as well. I mean, Avengers has those great moments, doesn't it, with Loki, which then pays off again in Ragnarok, and with Thor as well. And in this episode with them back in Avengers in the tower with the stairs. So I think you lose that with Ruffalo playing Ruffalo Hulk. But at the same time, I did find it endearing. I enjoyed him as that Hulk. But at the same time, he isn't that much different to the Beast in X-Men in that sort of thing, where he's abnormal but smart. And like I say, I think that plays off better in the comics than it probably does in the film. And in the film, I think it works because the film's got so many people in it. But if it was a standalone film, Professor Hulk would be quite dull. But I sort of kind of agree with you. I liked it, but I think there's a lot of limitations to doing Professor Hulk. And it only really works in that film because there's so many other things going on. It doesn't really matter that much.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Yeah.
Was yours sold out of interest?
Mine was sold out. No, it wasn't sold out. There was like 5 screens showing it almost simultaneously, though.
Fair enough.
So, you know, there was a few seats either side of us. It was a very packed cinema. The only times I've seen our cinema sold out have been for with Neil and I, and when that was at its 21st anniversary in 2011, I think, or something like that, and Doctor Who, Day of the Doctor. Those are the only times I've seen Middlesbrough Cineworld sold out. I'm sure they're not the only times, but they're the times I've been. Right. So
that's interesting.
God, there is such a lot to talk about with this movie, and we're going to spoil it. We're not going to give you we're talking about a film with spoilers, this a brand new film, so there's going to be spoilers, but we're not going to tell that this is what happens, this is what happens, this is what happens. We're going to be talking about things, and spoilery information is going to come into it, so let's get that in. There is something else about this movie, I didn't dislike it, but it did feel a little bit cheesy. But before we get to that, it's interesting how we've lost 2 female heroes in exactly the same place.
Yes, that's true.
Especially as one of them, spoiler time, one of them is Black Widow, and you know, people have been calling out for a Black Widow movie for ages, which seems like it might be a bit unlikely now.
No, it is likely, but they're prequeling it.
Ah, right, okay.
It's being set at the early 2000s. I suspect it's probably going to explore the comments that she has with Hawkeye over Budapest,
right.
Which has been on running, hasn't it, in the films?
Sure, yeah.
So I think it's going to. I think that's the plan for it. But yes, it is kind of odd to kill off a character that you're then one of your next movies is going to be highlighting. But maybe, and again, this is a quite smart strategy by Marvel to make that almost give that sort of an extra curiosity to it. That people have seen someone dead and now they're going to go and see a film where they're alive. So interesting tactic if that's the case.
Yeah. So obviously Black Widow died in the same place Gamora died in the previous movie, which I suppose that turns things around a bit because it looks like we're going to see more Gamora even though Gamora's dead.
There is a lot in this movie which pissed me off, and there's a lot of this movie which I thought was utterly brilliant. The things that piss me off, and given that we are a podcast largely situated around Doctor Who, in case you've just stumbled upon us, which was what the Mission to the Unknown reference was earlier, if you didn't understand that, the time travel elements in it piss me off. But the actual whole film itself, I thought was absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, the things like with Gamora, the stuff with Steve Rogers and... basically most of the time travel elements, while they were very enjoyable vignettes, their actual repercussions in terms of coherency were very frustrating. Gamora is one of those issues, to be honest. I mean, it's quite interesting that they've now done, and they did this as well with Loki as well, which I thought was quite clever, where they've killed characters off, brought them back, but brought them back in a way which means they're no longer the same characters as they were. So Loki now looks like he's going to exist in his own Disney Plus TV show in a sort of redundant break-off timeline so they can do what they want with him without having to worry about it impinging on the central franchise.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got, as you say, Gamora's come back, who doesn't have that same connection to Star-Lord as was in Volume 2 of Guardians of the Galaxy for Volume 3. So some really nice, clever things that they've done there in those sort of respects. But yeah, time was a really messy thing in there, which perhaps would have been better. And I really hate in Doctor Who, I hate the timey-wimey phrase, but I kind of feel that would have been better than having Banner sort of try and sort of almost lecture the audience on quantum mechanics and what you can do with time. And then for the film to just do whatever it wants with time, with no coherency. It's just like, that irritated me. Because as soon as I heard there was time travel elements in it, I was thinking, this is going to get messy. This is going to frustrate me unless they do it in a way which is consistent, which they didn't.
Yeah.
And so that was deeply problematic for me.
The time travel thing, I think we'll come to Steve Rogers in a moment. But the 1970s moment bit with Hank Pym and Howard Stark.
Yeah,
and then there was a very brief mention of Arno Stark, wasn't there, as well? He said, Arno, is that you? Which made me wonder whether this Arno Stark is a brother or another child, as has been more recently retconned into the Tony Stark family. Whereas originally, was he cousin?
I'm not sure.
I think back in the 80s, Arno Stark was a cousin who took control of Stark Enterprises and took the suit, and he was the Iron Man of 2020, and he was a mercenary, and he wasn't fussy about who paid him, which I think is a nice direction to go, to be honest with you, with Iron Man. I think it'd be interesting to have that in a movie.
Yeah, they could do. I mean, ultimately, I mean, obviously War Machine becomes Iron Man in several times in the history as well, so that's another possibility. I'd be very surprised if Disney totally put down Iron Man along with Downey Jr. He's far too symbolic now. I'd be very surprised. But yes, that's interesting. I hadn't noticed that.
But so Steve Rogers. Old Steve Rogers sitting on the bench at the end of the movie, having apparently lived throughout everything, although as an old man, gone back in time to finish off returning the various Infinity Stones, and then they send him off on a mission and he doesn't come back, And it's because he's been sat there all the time on a bench as an old man with a shield in a bag to give to Falcon. And as you say, the time travel thing is a bit of a mess because the implication has been that he's gone back and lived with Peggy Carter, but that's kind of probably hasn't happened. And they're kind of saying now that he's gone to he went into a parallel.
Well, some people are saying that.
Yeah.
But I've never understood the rationale because they'll say, oh, well, when he went back, it splits into a parallel, which then joins back to our to the primary timeline at this point. And it was like, well, why? Why does it suddenly do this weird curve back? It's a mess. The mess has just got worse. They upset me more and more as I went through. You know, the first mess for me, which really upset me, was probably back in New York, where Captain America fights Captain America, and then you have Star-Lord being knocked out at the beginning of Guardians of the Galaxy, and I'm starting to realise they're not going to do the thing which I thought they were going to do, which is to sneak around established continuity and do things behind the scenes to fix things. So they could then steal the stones, go to the future, and then, as they did at the end of the movie, go back, drop them back in the same place so no one would know any different. But then that was totally made pointless by Thanos and that storyline arc, where now he never took the stones, because instead of taking the stones and creating the problem in the first place, he goes to the future, fights them, gets the stones, loses, and the whole thing which had them go back in time to go and get the stones and for him to end up going in the future never happened because he never got the stones in the first place. And that sort of thing means you've got a massively fragmented timeline now because none of it really happened. And then to have Steve Rogers comfortably swim up the same timeline, which is what it suggests. It suggests that he goes back in time, becomes part of that timeline that they're in, and just exists quietly in it, living a retirement for those decades until he arrives back at the same time period where he says goodbye to them. But that whole middle bit of that timeline is now a massive mess. And people sort of say, well, he went back and he put the stones back in the right place. He put the hammer back in Midgard, so that was connected. So everything's back to normal. And you go, right, fine, it's back to normal. So you're saying that Thanos therefore destroys everything again, what does he live through? And I think the only way around you can get this is if you start saying, as what Banner says at the beginning, is that the present ultimately always remains the present. That you change time, it doesn't change the present. So it's almost like saying, in like other films like Back to the Future, where you create divergent timelines, but when you go back, you go forward again, you end up in that divergent timeline. The present always remains constant. Mm-hmm. And so whatever you do in the past, the present just remains what it is at that moment. And that kind of works until you have Steve Rogers navigating his way through it. And I'm still trying to get my head around it, trying to find a coherent way of understanding it, unless time is now sort of like loop-de-loops, which just goes round and round in sort of circular loops where, you know, Thanos does these various things and they almost become a continuity in themselves, not in terms of time, but in terms of events. So Thanos wins, they go back, Thanos then goes forward, loses, but that all becomes like a line rather than loops. It almost becomes like a straight line of events. So on those events, certain dates reoccur in a sense. It's almost like taking all those issues, all those loops, and straightening it into a long line. And maybe you can then live through that line.
Perhaps the loop ends at the moment Steve Rogers steps into the time machine, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
Which then he is then able to appear or be revealed to have been sat on the bench behind the time machine.
But what does he live through? What is his timeline?
Well, that's it, yeah.
I mean, the other way to look at it, which is probably the easiest way to look at it, and I've always thought of this with the Clark's continuity, the Kevin Smith universe, Askewiverse, isn't it? Is that if you look at Jay and Silent Bob's life compared to the guys in the store, they have very different worlds. You know, yeah. One ends up fighting the devil and whatever. One just ends up sitting 9 to 5 in a job. And in a way, you could almost say like life is like a prism, where light refracts between two points, and it refracts into multiple colors, which all go down the same direction, and to the end of time. They're all the same bits of light, but they're all slightly different. So Steve Rogers has a timeline which is different now to what the Falcon would have or would remember, in a sense. They would still exist concurrently, but ultimately their perceptions, their worlds are different because time isn't sort of like specific lines of events. It's like different perceptions of events or perceptions of worlds that sort of sit closely together. I don't know. It's a mess. I know people have said to me, stop overthinking it. And I argue, but overthinking is exactly the point of creativity. That's where you get new stories, is by thinking about things until you see new ways to interpret them. That's how creativity works. But it is frustrating at the same time. So, sorry, I've rambled about this for too long. I'm sure a lot of people just don't care and just enjoyed the movie. I did enjoy the movie a lot.
Give me, what was your best moment?
The end battle. Mm-hmm. I thought there was a lot of catharsism in there, and I think that comes from this being a really unique film, which I don't think will ever be replicated, certainly by Marvel, in the sense that it has this unique build-up of, what's it, like 15 films that all lead to this point, which is an incredible amount of material, which is all high-octane material throughout, which leads to some moments where you can't help but feeling that sort of weird butterfly in your stomach, which occasionally you might get for nostalgia when you first saw the Millennium Falcon fly. But now you're sort of, it's fluttering for the whole time. And I'm not a massive Marvel fan. I mean, I loved the comics when I was a kid. I've watched the films, but I couldn't tell you which Infinity Stones are in which films. I couldn't tell you where they were from. When they started talking about where the Infinity Stones came from, I couldn't remember which was which. I don't have that sort of love for it. But there was something so beautifully powerful in those last moments of the way that they sort of combined all those people, all those characters that you enjoyed, the tension, the speed. It was a really, and then you had some really moving moments in that last act, which I thought was interesting, that the moving moment for Robert Downey Jr. was not with, for Tony Stark, was not with Potts, but it was actually with Peter Parker. Mm. And the film knew that as well. The film plays that moment, I think, far stronger than it does the Pepper Potts bit on the death. And I think that, again, is very, very powerful.
I think it's interesting what you say there about the stones. I think Avengers Assemble and the Captain America First Avenger and Doctor Strange, they're the only ones that are really about the Infinity Stones, aren't they?
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh yeah, I've forgotten about that. But
no, exactly. That's what I mean.
But I mean, they've been really clever with kind of how they've used the Infinity Stones, rather.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a way that they haven't made the movies, obviously about any particular stone, except maybe if you get, you know, Doctor Strange and Guardians of the Galaxy, specifically about the stones, I suppose. That they're like very key to them, aren't they? So, but yeah, it's. I agree with you. It's clever how they've not distracted us with stones, but yet made the stones key to everything.
My friend last year when we saw Infinity War said, "Oh well, you know, it's just another cash cow." And it's like, no, it's doing something entirely different. These two films have done something never done before in film history. The amount of characters that are interplaying in there, which are interplaying with this sort of these other intertexts or these other Marvel films, and we're seeing this all play out into these cohesive holes, which may have a few frayed bits around the edges, but are cohesive and smart films. There's been nothing like this before.
No,
like,
and also, you know, you've got
Doctors on Octane.
You've got to credit the actors and the scriptwriters as well for having these perfectly honed archetype characters. They're instantly recognisable. That don't really require you to have watched the Iron Man films or the Captain America films.
No.
Or yeah. Doctor Strange or the Hulk films or Captain Marvel. You could have just watched the five Avenger films.
Yeah.
Four Avenger films.
There's good payoffs in there. And yeah. I like that. And, it's funny because someone said on Twitter how this is a film which would never get an Oscar. And, what it does, it's not really about superpowers. It's about family. It's about overcoming social disorder, because you obviously have the 5-year period. Mm-hmm. It's about it's about sacrifice, and you've got these horrendously well cast characters, because the reason Marvel, in my opinion, works so well is that the casting is, they worked out with Iron Man that I think we've said this before, with Iron Man that you can have Robert Downey Jr. on the screen 75% of the time and it's engaging. You don't go to it to watch the silly metal suit. You go for it for Downey Jr. Mm. You go to Spider-Man now largely for Tom Holland.
Yeah.
And again, the Hulk, Mark Ruffalo, he sells it to me far more than Ed Norton did Saturday. And I thought Ed Norton would be brilliant. You get the right casting, you make it work. Thor, again, brilliantly played. There are some questions around what they did with Thor and whether there was, there is a question of having someone who's going through PTSD, who's in substance abuse and has become overweight through it. And the film laughs at it. And I laughed as well. But I wonder whether in 10 years time that will look a bit dated. But ultimately, he was great comic relief throughout the film. And I was kind of glad he never sort of suddenly became shredded again at any point. What he'd done to his body was what he'd done to his body. So, and the alcoholism, I thought they played, actually, even though they played it for laughs, they played it fairly true. Like when he's back in Asgard, it's not Midgard, Asgard, and he doesn't go with Rocket to go and get the Infinity Stone. He actually goes off to go and find some more alcohol and then bumps into his mum. That to me felt quite honest to, some of the issues with sort of substance abuse. You don't just suddenly snap out of it when the story needs you to.
Yeah.
So there were some good things that they played in on that. I think it's about they've made so many good calls with characters that you want to see all of them in that movie. You want to see the Guardians, you want to see the Avengers, you want to see Ant-Man. So you're never bored. You're never going, oh God, I wish I was just watching so-and-so here. You want to see them all. And that's a very smart tactic. But can they do it again? I don't know. Because you've done this once, are people going to just sit waiting for the next 15 films to go and do this again? Is this something which is just so unique that you couldn't really play it out twice? I don't know.
Maybe in 15 films' time.
But then you have an expectation. It's a thing of the past, isn't it?
There is an expectation.
A point of comparison. We don't have that at the moment.
No, I just think maybe... Right now is what I think is in 15 years' time, maybe, or 15 movies' time, I suppose, at the current rate is probably 5 years' time. Mm-hmm. Maybe the expectation will be different. They'll be aiming to do something completely different, I suppose. It'll be a different setup, so they'll be going in a different direction. And one of the things that annoyed me about Captain Marvel, which is the same thing that probably annoyed most people about Captain Marvel, whereas the Skrulls not being the bad guys, but there's plenty of time for other Skrulls to be the bad guys. So that's one option. I liked it in a way.
It's subverting what I expected.
Yeah, and obviously the guy playing the lead Skrull, whose name escapes me, is Ben Mendelsohn, wasn't it? It's really good. So that sold it for me. But like the realization, which for me was about 5 minutes in, that the Kree were not the good guys, was and that the Skrull therefore probably had to be the good guys, or at least as bad as the Kree, then that still annoys me a little bit. But I think they got away with it because of who they cast, I think.
Well, I think, again, what I liked about it was there was a feeling that I didn't think that they would ever go back, that would be a permanent state. And it's kind of nice to see that races are not all homogenous in their sort of intent,
yes,
are they? Different. Some might be nice, but then you might get a whole load that are horrible or bad or different agendas. So I think as long as they didn't do it for every film, I had no issue with that. I thought that was quite a nice twist, because that was what I was expecting, especially after recent Skrull wars in the comics and how they were used as sort of signification of the invisible enemy, the terrorist.
Yeah. The only thing with that, of course, is that it's totally obvious direction to take, isn't it? So I mean, there's all sorts of theories as to who's going to be the new big threat in the Marvel universe, isn't there? The cinematic universe.
I've not even thought about it, but yes, that was a good point. I don't know.
So I mean, there's maybe a discussion for another time. But I mean, I've seen the Kang the Conqueror mentioned. As some sort of supercharged super scroll. Someone suggested the Beyonder somewhere on Reddit, but I think that would be extremely unlikely, because I don't think you can do the Beyonder, to be honest with you. I think that'd be silly. The big guy Galactus is another one, or just keeping things more. In some ways, they kind of have to. I mean, the X-Men are kind of all right. The X-Men don't have too much of a problem other than existing in a kind of separate universe. But someone really has to do something with the Fantastic Four.
Well, the X-Men, they've now got rights to the X-Men, so the X-Men will be somewhere in the next stage. So
yeah,
maybe,
but what I'm saying is they don't have to worry about the X-Men. Because, you know, everything's working quite well with the X-Men. But in terms, I mean, the Fantastic Four, they've done three Fantastic Four movies, two separate casts, and they're just not working at all, really. And they're kind of key to bringing in particular people, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it's about the charm factor. I think also, I wonder with Fantastic Four, they would be smarter taking a leaf out of, out of Fox's book, to be fair, and doing something like First Class, or like Days of Future Past, and actually situating the Fantastic Four within the 60s, which would be an environment which I think would probably suit their simplicity, because they are quite a simple team.
Well, they kind of went halfway there with the last. Yeah, they went halfway there with the last movie and having a younger cast than the previous movie. But I think I'd agree with you with that. Yeah,
and I think the cinema's learning as well that there is a sort of curiosity and a charm to setting outside of contemporary settings, as Captain Marvel enjoyed horrendously with its sort of 90s drop of music and artifacts. Days of Future Past enjoyed in the 70s, Apocalypse no one enjoyed, First Class, you know. So I think there is that feeling that maybe that's what I would do if I was doing Fantastic Four, and give it a sort of like a give it an aesthetic which sort of gives it a charm, as much as you say, good casting. That'd be interesting.
Captain Marvel's hair, I like Captain Marvel having long hair, because it's a good visual thing. It's a good, you know, it's part of her, you know, the old, you know, to paraphrase Russell T Davies, a silhouette. So she has short hair. It doesn't work for me as well. I just like the glowy hair, you know. I've always liked the glowy hair on Captain Marvel. But it's not a big issue. Do you know my favorite? I have two favorite moments. Okay.
Go on.
In Endgame. The first one was when Scott Lang's reunited with his daughter.
Yeah.
You've got that history between the two characters already, which you don't really have with Tony Stark and Morgan.
Yeah.
So when he sees his daughter, that's a really good moment for me. And the other one has got to be that big visual double page center spread in the battle when everyone's running towards each other. When everyone comes back. Yeah. And then there's that just. That it's fantastic visual. It's so cleverly, just like that's, you know, that to take that recognizable sort of comic strip center pages or double page spread that's been done countless times over the years and put it on a big screen, and that they haven't, and there's kind of calls to it in Civil War and stuff, but having that type of thing right there, that's I really like that.
Yeah, I like the at the moment where I got that sort of butterfly feeling again, even though, again, I'm not a massive Marvel fan, was the Captain America with the hammer.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really strong, powerful moment that was just the way how they took that. there was just things like that that were good all the way through. As I say, I thought Tony Stark's resolution was nicely done. It wasn't overplayed. I thought he played it really well. He's had a good run in those movies. I think this is a good time to bow.
Yeah.
I think the way they treated Evans's Captain America was wise as well, because his character was in a different position to Stark. I kind of felt with Stark, apart from giving him the happy family life, the typical masculine man living in the woods, in the log cabin sort of thing, I didn't really feel nowhere else it was for him to go. But with Captain America, there was stuff that had been really unresolved, and that was the whole point of him. There was stuff that really couldn't be resolved because it was lost to time. Yeah. So I thought that there was a nice choice in how they reconciled both characters. And it's also fascinating from a celebrity point of view, you know, like that last scene where they have all his friends together, where they're seeing the by the lake, and you sort of have just that one moment of general. This is why I'm saying the other night, I'm getting old. I can't remember names that I've known all my life. General from the Hulk.
Oh, was he there?
Yeah, he's in the background.
Yes, he was, wasn't he? Because he was in one of the early Avengers films, wasn't he?
He was, yes.
Was it the last one or the one before? He was in Civil War.
General Ross.
Yeah, I think it was in Civil War, wasn't it? It was him who told them all to stand down, wasn't it? Yeah.
So you got General Ross there, and you say there was the kid from the third Iron Man film.
Yeah.
And there was just all these little, you know, nods, which would have been expensive, but as you said at the beginning, not really a big issue for this film. But it's as if it was very in tune with the audience of doing this sort of film, this sort of high spectacle, no hold bars. You just go all the way out. And it went all the way out on every front, and that was pretty incredible. It just didn't stop wherever it needed to go. It went, that's a massive bar to. I must admit, DC must have just been sort of like, you know, well, what do we do now? You know, we've tried to rush to catch up with them, and that's not gone brilliantly well. I mean, okay, we've had a couple of reasonable films that people have said have been all right, like Wonder Woman and Aquaman, but we're still not really in the right space, are we?
Well, you've got to suggest maybe they get Chris Nolan back on speed dial, because the only way they're going to get anywhere back in the game is with Christian Bale and Chris Nolan, I think.
Well, Nolan's largely derided now because, as we've said before, you know, you can't have a bad end. And
well, yeah.
That film sort of seems to have sullied people's memories of the first two. And there's a lot of people who don't like Nolan.
The box office would disagree with him.
But then saying that, I mean, I've not checked the stats, but some have been sort of saying that the Captain Marvel film actually eclipses the combined box office of all the Batman films. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. So don't quote me on that. It was one of those sort of newsfeed articles which I didn't check. But I think there is a certain argument that the stakes now, the level, as you're saying, with Endgame, if not with Captain Marvel, are so high. And I still think the big problem for DC is they've just not found, they've not learned, like Marvel's learned to let to feel totally confident with the source material and let that guide you and then play on that, while DC is still constantly trying to reinterpret the source material for film as if they're never quite sure what tone it should be in, while Marvel's sort of like, you know, sorry, this is going to be the tone for this. This is going to be kick. This is going to be colourful and exciting. Since Guardians of the Galaxy, as we've said before, they seem to have worked out that what people need in films at the moment is fun, escapism and comedy. And so they found their tone, which has been fairly consistent since then, bar these two movies, which were planned way in advance. But they still have a bit of fun to them. And I think DC has a lot to... DC's got to sit back. It's got to, I think, you know, when it's doing Superman should be like Captain America. It shouldn't be tonally like Batman.
No. And I think as well, I mean, obviously they've got the Joker film this year.
Yeah, well, I have issues with that as well.
Well, I hope that is purely a character piece, because if it goes beyond being a character piece, given who is in it, as a start. If it goes beyond being a character piece, it's going to end up looking ridiculous, I think.
Well, there's also the question of, you know, of the humanization of people who are terrible. You know, the Joker is the ultimate terrorist, isn't he? He's a terrible, terrible person. And, you know, in an era where, you know, there are a lot of terrible things that are committed, single acts, there is that argument is, you know, does this romanticize it? I don't know. So I think automatically DC has created questions which will probably plague it a little bit when it comes to...
DC's great has two great strengths, hasn't it? It was Batman and Superman, and maybe Wonder Woman as well. Like, historically, I'm not talking recently. And, you know, Superman's, like, key era was sort of late 70s, early 80s, and Wonder Woman, again, really, in terms of TV at the same time. Batman's obviously had more of a success in beyond comics on TV. And the most fun I have had reading a DC comic in the past 20 years was reading Batman 1966.
Okay, yeah.
Which is just so much bloody fun. And yes, it's silly. And yes, it's clearly the 60s Batman TV show in comic strip form. But you've got to say, you know, as you suggested with the First Class stuff and maybe an answer for Fantastic Four, maybe that's what DC need to be doing. They're just taking Batman back to what, you know, despite Michael Keaton and everything that happened after that and Joel Schumacher and all the way through Nolan, maybe they just need to go back to what people recognize as being Batman.
And camp
things up a little bit.
I think
because that works for your villains as well, doesn't it?
But DC has been plagued by its own success, the success of those early superhero films in Batman and Batman Returns especially, sort of set the footprint for Batman, which it's never escaped from, which is it's always about high-tech suits, it's always about high-tech vehicles. It's you know, even his mask is almost identical as it was, with the same black eyeliner underneath it. You know, there's never been any real sort of, they've not been able to pull away from that success, and they go back to dip into that for Batman. And I think they've got to really go back to basics and go, well, what is Batman really? How do we need to define him? And, you know, a lot of the times Batman is essentially a detective ninja in a suit, a humorous one if you go back to the 60s. And maybe they need to be looking at new ways of trying to interpret him. And as you say, situating him in the 60s would be a way of doing that. And I should say, I mean, there's a lot of DC stuff I do love. I mean, I've always loved Batman. The Batman animated series and the DC animated series was fantastic. Their animated line has taken a lot of risks.
Yeah,
Brave and the Bold was, very much tongue-in-cheek Batman. I know a lot of people hate it, but the Titans series, both Teen Titans and Titans Go, people might not like them, but in television, they take far more risks, and they allow their creative teams to be a lot more free and fun, and it works for them.
Well, Teen Titans for me is as good as The Simpsons was 20 years ago.
Yeah,
it's so much fun, and it's taking the piss everywhere, and it's just it's subverting, you know, narratives, and you're taking the Mickey out of, you know, popular culture. It's so good.
Yeah, absolutely, and I mean it's not perfect, but I have enjoyed Gotham. The Titans Netflix series I thought was pretty good. So it's not for a moment trying to sort of straddle this ridiculous horse of, you know, DC versus Marvel. But Marvel has just done stuff in the cinema which has shocked, I think, everyone from every genre, to the amount of money it's making, to the scale it's doing in terms of, not just in terms of the film, but in terms of films and sequels, which have always been considered to be mistakes, you know, cash cows, which get worse with every one. They've tapped into comics, yes, and managed to bring comics to the screen, because comics do all this. They do crossover. They do multiple genres. Some of them are crazy. Some of them are serious. They do people dying and coming back to life. They do all the stuff, but they've tapped into that really, 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 really well. And DC's yet to find its avenue, I think. And unfortunately, with the pressure of seeing Marvel do so well, it cuts a few corners and just doesn't manage to, you know, Justice League after two films. It's like, no, you know, Avengers had several films before they went down that route. You know, you're rushing. You might be better doing, like you were just saying again, anthology ones, sort of ones which are standalone on different heroes, maybe in different time periods, which don't connect to any others, like they do with the animated stuff. You know, the Batman and Superman stuff they do now. They do those standalone movies of Doomsday or Killing Joke, which aren't interconnected but are just standalone releases. Maybe they should be doing the opposite of Marvel and doing some really good, solid standalone things, which some would argue this Joker movie is. So, yeah. It's a really
Have you seen the Spider-Verse movie yet?
I've not, no. I've heard I must admit, I'm not overly engaged in it. I remember the comics of that sort of period, and I can't see the interest, but people say it's great, so I will see it and make my own mind up on it. But
well, my son has been convinced that Spider-Man is dead, so he's refused to do anything new with Spider-Man. So he won't watch it until he knows he's not dead.
It's an interesting point. Interesting take.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was absolutely stunned and cried his eyes out for like a day after Infinity War. So that moment he flies through the portal in Endgame, I know that when Bruce comes to see that, he will be cheering.
And that's another good thing the film does, is it knows, it's very in tune with its audience. It knows when they bring Spider-Man back, that character's got to have a fair bit of airtime. That's what audiences are after. So it gives him a nice chunk. It plays off the moments that people want to see. It plays off the moment, like you say, with Ant-Man and his daughter. It plays off the Tom Holland and Danny Jr. It knows where to hit those marks. It is a masterpiece, and I still think, is while it's unfortunately low pop culture, it should be getting awards, these two films, because it is like nothing film has done before.
Absolutely.
And just because it's popular shouldn't derive from the fact that it is extremely well constructed. It's not just about special effects. There's some good story in there. It's great performances. Good comedy, the tone's right. Then you can see they're consciously very aware at every beat what they're doing, and they're doing it well. There's no rushing. Like I say, the time stuff is a mess, but then I guess you have to say the time stuff is a mess in the comics as well. So they're not doing anything the comics wouldn't do. How many mess ups have they had? Yeah, it was about Spider-Man and Loki getting rid of his Mary Jane marriage in the comics. So now his timeline is sort of like before, but slightly different. Who knows how? And it's that same sort of approach. It's like, you know, just deal with it. So, yeah, it's annoying to fawn about something so much, but it really was. I didn't feel like 3 hours to me. It felt...
Well, it felt like 3 hours to my bladder, but...
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I was in VIP seats as well, which was...
Very nice.
Yeah.
Oh, well, get you. I think there's two other things I might mention. I did find the girl power thing a little bit cheesy in the battle.
I was watching that and I was imagining so many angry people tip-tapping on their keyboards. But then, I mean, at the same time, there's a lot of people on Twitter sort of saying, and maybe you can connect this with your son, that their daughter screamed with pleasure at that moment. And it's like, you know, this is actually important for some people in the audience. It might not be something that we all get, but for some people, that is a really important message to send, even if for others it feels quite heavy.
I think it's a good visual. I think the dialogue maybe killed it for me. I think that's maybe where I am with that. It felt more cheesy than anything. You know, I mean, it looked good. It was a good visual, as I say. I think, yeah, maybe I'm just an old man.
But I think if you think again, it depends on how we, it goes back to what I was saying about the prism, how we see life is very different. And because I've never been a woman or lived in a woman's world, I've never known what sort of pressures are there. I mean, when I'm if I'm hanging out with girls who are ladies who are attractive and young, I'm amazed at how many men will talk to them, not in a pervy way, not in a sort of salacious way, but will acknowledge their existence in a way that my existence is never acknowledged. And it makes me realize that how we live. We live in very different worlds because people interact with people, certain types of people and certain genders in very different ways, which probably means that unity of women in that moment probably has a far more of a catharsism for particular people than it would for, say, yourself or myself. I know my mum always says that as well. She says, yeah, I remember being young and how all I'd have to do is get off a bus and the bus driver would say something nice to me and it'd be great. She says, get to 45, I don't exist anymore. I'm a ghost. And, you know, there is that interesting thing of perspectives. Yeah. And it's, yeah, which is kind of fascinating. But, yeah, I think it spoke to a lot of people that moment. But
yeah, I mean, my daughter's not really into hero movies, so I can't really get a kind of feedback from her when the time comes. I don't know, maybe she won't care that she's never seen any of them before, really, beyond Black Widow and Scarlet Witch. So I don't think she's seen Black Panther, so no, yeah. We'll see. The other thing as well, I know we mentioned the return to the New York scene. The way they played with the Winter Soldier lift moment,
yeah,
elevator battle, and like completely took it in a new direction and had that famous bit of comic dialogue from recent comics thrown in there from Captain America. It was quite very, very knowing, very clever, and very kind of we can do this as well, and this is how we're doing it.
But also beautifully irrelevant if you didn't know what that was.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, that comment would obviously hail back, coin a phrase, to, as you say, Winter Soldier. So people following the films could pick up on that. But like you say, if you know what's going on in the comic threads, then it has that extra layer of intertextuality, which I think, again, is smart.
That's the word I was looking for.
It's smart when you can do that without making it a point that someone misses something or loses something from it. I mean, I think ultimately you go and see this film. It's called Avengers. It is sort of kind of saying that, you know, you should have probably seen, we'd expect you probably to have seen these films, which we tap into, certainly the Avengers films that we tap into and the Guardians of the Galaxy, but you should still be able to enjoy it without. But then to go into the comics layers without actually going to the comic layers is kind of fun. I enjoyed it. I thought those bits with the Hulk were good in the past as well. The stairs were some nice moments. I liked the fact that I have Hawkeye with his ankle bracelet to sort of, again, another nod back to Civil War, that there are repercussions, which is played out again in Ant-Man and Wasp. So, it's just a pretty solid franchise.
Yeah,
it is.
And the crazy thing is that it's not over.
Yeah,
in 2019, we have X-Men Dark Phoenix still to come, Spider-Man Far From Home, The New Mutants. Yeah, it's three more Marvel films this year alone, excuse me. And then there's...
But New Mutants and the X-Men Dark Phoenix still aren't interconnected, are they?
No, they're not. Well, I think, is New Mutants, is that still staying Fox behind?
I think that's still Fox.
Yeah. That appears, is that... Oh, no, it's not.
That's been massively delayed. I remember that trailer coming out about a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it does.
Which is interesting. Yeah, so, absolutely, there's those films. And we've, as you said, Disney Plus is getting their streaming channel where they'll be running a Loki TV series. Hawkeye's getting a TV series, I think. There's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I think, might be having Hawkeye in it as well. I think he's going around the place. You say we've got the Black Widow prequel coming up. You say you've got Spider-Man, you've got Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, which looks like they might be moving Thor into that area.
That'll be fun.
That should be fun. That was a nice end sequence as well with Thor.
Yes, wasn't it, Jill? That's what sent me over the edge of having to go to the toilet. I was laughing so much.
Yeah, he fits that perfectly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's loads of stuff. And as I say, now they're centralising content for their streaming channel.
Mm.
It'll be interesting to see, as always, whether the Mighty Falls, if it dilutes or does stuff which just doesn't quite match up.
I tell you what, I do have a bit of a problem with Chris Hemsworth at the moment. Having seen the Men in Black trailer with the movie.
Oh, yes.
I now want Chris Hemsworth to play James Bond.
Yeah, it could be quite interesting. I have a lot of time.
I wasn't on this train before I saw him in a suit, and I thought, hold on a minute. You know, he would be the perfect kind of alt, you know, contrast to Daniel Craig.
But this is, again, if we talk, I mean, just thinking about the finances behind these movies, what's so horrendously clever and slash disgusting, we talk about Chris. I mean, I always found one of the worst movies in the Marvel franchise was Thor 2, which I just found, even though Mr. Christopher Eccleston plays a good part in it, it just felt very fragmented, dour and slightly boring.
Dour's definitely, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The way that things like Endgame works, where it starts revisiting these and sort of giving them extra life by sort of creating new engagements in them, means that they sort of hoist older films which perhaps didn't meet the mark up a level. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Thor 2 has more relevancy. You can go back and watch that with a new understanding to it. And it's a very clever when a new film is actually in some ways going back and re-energizing previous films in their franchise, which might mean future sales. More people going and getting, well, I didn't like Thor 2, but now I need to see it again after seeing that bit in Endgame. And so those levels, that commercial level, there's some disgustingly clever motives, and I'm sure well thought out motives behind it. Yeah, those just very, very smart all the way through. My only grievance is I just felt the time stuff was just a little too messy for me to be able to sit and just go with it. I think if they'd said it at the beginning with Banner and just said, just go with it, or explained how it worked, so I'd be prepared for it rather than having to guess all the way through and my brain trying to interconnect all this stuff. That was my only grumble. Because now we have people, and I'll be interested, this will be another interesting thing with this Marvel franchise. Comes to Spider-Man, which I keep calling Spider-Man colon abroad, because I can't remember his name. Spider-Man abroad. Will they mention the fact that half his classmates will now be 5 years behind? Will all the ones from the Spider-Man Homecoming have to have been knocked out by the Infinity Wars?
Yes, I think I've read something. I think all the key ones that are still there have all got dusted. So they've all come back 5 years later and they're all in the same class. And some other ones have left.
I mean, that's a remarkable amount of heaviness to have to cover. Yet at the same time, that's what you have to do if you play this sort of gambit, that you create this essentially network of a single story almost.
Well, we don't know. We won't know until the film comes out. But I suspect Aunt May will not have been dusted.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, they've done some great stuff like that. And even in Endgame, there was a lot of references or resolutions to the Civil War fallout as well. So that was still being played out between Rogers and Stark. And I really like that. That's what I like about these films, is it doesn't, unlike maybe Game of Thrones at the moment, where the stuff is, perhaps the pacing has shifted somewhat in its wrap up. The Marvel films seem so very confident with that they're going to go on forever. They don't seem to sort of ever rush anything. Stuff seems to get the right amount of attention, which is clever.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, let's begin to wrap this up finally. Yep. But we have talked in the past about Wolverine and Hugh Jackman and how I personally can't see anyone else playing Wolverine. I can't see anyone else playing Captain America or Iron Man. Not Tony Stark, anyway. I just don't see that happening. So, and obviously the cinematic universe has its own timeline and history and everything. And, you know, in the comics, these guys have been going on forever and then they've been reset and they've been going on and continuing. But I find the idea of replacing characters is, in the comics, I've always felt it not always felt a little pointless, but it's kind of come. I have felt it a little pointless in replacing fictional characters in a format where there's no actor. They are just a drawing. There's no need to replace them with other people doing the same job. But it's perfect for the movies, I think.
Mm. Yeah.
But I still can't see anyone else playing Wolverine.
No, yeah, I know. I mean, I think Fox missed a massive opportunity, which some have argued there's rumours that New Mutants may address, but I don't think it will, is whether the X-13 should have immediately been pushed forward into action to its own film, which I know to change the Wolverine thing, but I think it sort of cements the idea that you don't have to find another Wolverine. You've got other versions of Wolverine, which I think could have been just as interesting for audiences, that you would feel the need to, for a while, to be thinking, how do we recast this character? They will eventually. But I think the talk is, like with all the X-Men, is that they'll probably wait a while before they start introducing them to give a bit of space. But I mean, they've done it with everyone else, but I can't imagine anyone being as good as Wolverine. But then I was like that with Keaton. I still think Keaton's the best Batman for me. I watched Birdman the other day as well, and it was quite interesting to see those sort of reflections of that era in that film.
Yeah.
But yeah, Jackman's been so, yeah.
Yeah, Hugh Jackman has been fantastic, and just so so recognisable in as Wolverine, as you know, as Downey Jr. as his
yeah.
Tony Stark, and Chris Evans as Steve Rogers. So yeah, Beyond Cast Jerbis brings you an in-depth discussion of Avengers Endgame, which, to be honest, could have gone on a lot longer than it did. We look forward to your comments on our discussion, and yeah, until next time, from us, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.